Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. One of the key determinants in predicting personal success, is it talent and intelligence or passion and perseverance? Well, social science research is pointing to the latter, or as my guest refers to it, grit. Psychologist Angela Duckworth has explored the science of why some succeed and others fail, and she says grit, the passion for the task and the perseverance to succeed in spite of difficulties and obstacles, is a key personality trait for achievement. Today, she consults for West Point, the White House, and the World Bank on gritty characteristics of their personnel. Angela Duckworth is a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, where she recently co-founded the Character Lab, which advances the science and practice of character development in children. She holds degrees from Harvard and Oxford, and she was a 2013 recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, or Genius Grant. And her book, Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance, describes her theories on grit. And she also talks with what she calls grit paragons, people like Seattle Seahawks coach Pete Carroll, New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Minkoff, or J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon, among others, on passion and perseverance's role in success. She joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Angela Duckworth, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have been studying how and what role perseverance and one's passion, or grit as you call it, can be the key to success. What led you towards trying to understand that question and that answer of how perseverance plays a role in overall success?
Before I became a psychologist, I was teaching kids how to do math. I was a middle school and high school math teacher. And, you know, like any teacher, you fill in the grades at the end of every quarter or at the end of the year. And I think what was so striking to me as a teacher was, you know, how differently the kids performed in my class, even though I was their teacher. So they had the same teacher, they had the same math book, they had the same homework assignments. And how, if you thought about their aptitude for math, their talent for math, how for sure that had something to do with who did well and who didn't do as well. But that to me, it seemed like there was so much more that was going on there. It wasn't just talent. It was absolutely a huge, you know, consequence of their effort, of the amount and the quality of their effort that they were able to sustain over that year. That turned me into a psychologist. I said, I got to understand this, because if you're going to really help people succeed, you have to understand why and when people work hard. And so that kind of set me on this path. When I got to graduate school and I started interviewing people who were highly accomplished in their field, and I asked them the question, who do you most admire, and tell me what they're like, they told me about sustaining effort. They told me about being a hard worker, about finishing things that you start. And they told me about, you know, not getting bored with something too quickly. They told me about being kind of obsessed with something, at least at the level where you would come back to it. Not that you're crazy, but that you'd be consistently interested in and engaged in a project.
Now, going back to your classroom days, you tell the story in the book of one student named David, I believe it was Wong, I believe his name was. And this was after you'd moved from teaching a varied socioeconomic class of students to this very highly charged prep academy on the West Coast. And you were teaching the basic level algebra. And here was this kid that was like making straight A's, but he was in this class and because he was very quiet. And you found that, in fact, he was incredibly gritty by your sort of definition of what grit is.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, I just saw him. He, you know, came back and visited me. He still calls me Mrs. Duckworth, which I like. And it was, I don't know how many years it's been since he was sitting in the back of a ninth grade classroom, because now he's all grown up and is still the gritty kid that I know for sure. If anything, you know, grittier, you know, learned his lessons. I think what I learned from David is that the aptitude that a kid might show on a test in eighth grade, which is how he ended up in my ninth grade class, that he didn't score high enough to be in the more advanced math class, that, you know, these things are not perfectly reliable crystal balls about what a kid can do. And when I saw that he did so well, you know, scoring perfectly on all my quizzes and all my tests and asking for extra homework, you know, I said, what the heck are you doing in my class? And when we got him into the more advanced class, he got his PhD in engineering from UCLA, and he is quite literally a rocket scientist. I mean, he works for Aerospace Corporation. And I think he's a great example of what you can do when you love something. I mean, he really enjoyed, and he was in math. I mean, he would say he enjoyed it more than he was talented in it, but that got him to really stay engaged. So I think there are lots of lessons to learn from these kids. And I think that when kids are given the message that, you know, you'll never be able to do this because you don't have enough aptitude or talent, you know, it's not that talent doesn't matter, but I think so often we're putting false limits on kids and that they can do so much more than maybe even we can imagine at a certain moment in time.
And I think we're also impressed by natural talent, natural intelligence, and IQ, and this idea of genius, of naturals, if you will.
Yeah, I think there's absolutely that. In fact, when I was talking to David, that student, you know, all grown up now, now a rocket scientist, about this, you know, he even today says things like, you know, I'm not the smartest person in this company. You know, there are definitely people here who are smarter than me. Like, why do we continue to ask questions like that, even well into adulthood? And it's not that we should beat ourselves up about it. I just think we should be curious about why we ask those questions. You know, why don't we ask about what we're doing and our accomplishments more than our potential? We shouldn't, I think, be so fixated on whether we're naturals or not naturals. There's something called imposter syndrome. It's the idea in psychology, it's been documented that, you know, oftentimes you feel like, God, how did I get in here? I'm not smart enough. I'm not talented enough to be here. I'm an imposter. And recently on book tour, I was at Google, and it was interesting that at a place like that, these very, very smart programmers, you know, one after the other would tell me like, oh yeah, when I got here, after the first couple of weeks and I kind of got my bearings, I just kind of wondered, am I smart enough to be here? So I think we should be curious about why we're so fixated on these things. And, you know, how many of us still remember our SAT scores well into adulthood? And I think so much of life is not about these aptitude tests and whether we're, quote unquote, smart enough to do something, but really whether we love it, whether we care about it, and how hard we're willing to work at it.
Now, when you have somebody that has that imposter syndrome, does that encourage them to work harder and persevere or get discouraged?
Well, you know, it can go both ways, but I think one of the things that is not great about imposter syndrome is it can lead you to drop out of things, right? Like, oh, I don't belong here. You know, everyone else is smarter than me. And I think it can lead you to be too quiet, you know, when you need help, like when you actually don't know how to do something, you need to ask. And if you feel like, oh, gosh, I don't want to show that I'm the imposter, then that will inhibit you from asking those questions. One of the most successful people I know personally is a professor named Katie. She's a professor at Wharton, and she was an engineering major at Princeton, and she was a jock before she was an engineering major. And so she sort of found herself in these really hard classes. And she said the most important thing that she ever learned is that she could look around and see who was really successful. And she just sidled up to that person and said, dude, how do I like study here? What am I doing wrong? Like, how did you solve that problem? And I think that's a really powerful life lesson that, you know, it's not a sign of weakness to ask for help. And I think if imposter syndrome gets in the way of saying like, well, how do I be more successful? Give me some advice. Then, in fact, it can be, you know, really an important obstacle.
That was gets into one of these things about how to nurture grit, if you will. And I can't remember who it was, but it was, if you want to be better, say, at athletics or something like that, join a great team, because that peer excellence sort of is not only a motivator for you to work harder, but it's kind of like that sort of thing rubs off. Is that?
Yeah, that's the observation of a sociologist named Dan Chambliss, who has, as many sociologists do, spent a lot of time just observing people in groups. And one of his very first studies was to look at swimmers, spent about half dozen years living with swim teams of all different levels of competitiveness, all the way up to Olympic hopefuls. And his major observation was that, you know, if you want to be great at something, first of all, it is doable. You might think, I'm not a natural, I'm not talented enough. But if you break something down like being a great swimmer into the tiny, tiny little parts that required, you know, that are required of greatness, each of those little things is actually doable and practicable and trainable. And so that was one of his insights. But the second one is, as you point out, he said, look, if you want to be a great swimmer, join a great swim team, because you will, like all human beings, begin to conform to the group. You'll start waking up early like they do, and you'll start working hard at practice like they do, and you'll start, you know, in some ways imitating excellence. And he even went so far as saying recently, because I asked him to come to my university and give a talk, he said, look, if you want to learn French, you can take classes, you can buy a book, you can try to practice on Saturday mornings. But if you really want to learn French, you know, be born in France. And he was sort of joking, but his point was, like, think about it. Like, all those little kids in France speak it fluently, and it's because everybody else is. So there is a real power to the group. And I think if you want to be grittier, you know, you could harness that by, you know, finding a group of people who are the hardworking, resilient, passionate people you want to be like. And I think soon enough, you will find yourself in a way imitating and even emulating them.
Getting back to that idea of falling into the belief of naturals, you know, whether it be in the arts or a natural athlete, you do spend quite a bit of time on swimming. You talk to Rowdy Gaines, and you tell the story from a swimming coach about the day Mark Spitz showed up to train with Rowdy Gaines, and Rowdy Gaines is a generation younger, so Spitz was close pulling in on 40, and, you know, Rowdy Gaines was at his height, and they did sprints. And he said all the swimmers congregated around to watch Mark Spitz, even though Rowdy Gaines was winning the races, because they were sort of lulled in this idea of he's a natural, he's this fish in water, and they sort of forgot all the things that they were working on, all this hard work and perseverance to become a champion.
You know, it's so easy to forget, isn't it? Because I think when you look at real excellence, whether it be swimming or writing, you know, I think everything has excellence, every craft. You know, hosting a radio show, I mean, everything. You could say, like, wow, that's the apogee. That's the pinnacle of doing that. And when you look at that kind of excellence, it's so reliably fluent. There aren't any hard parts. There aren't any stumbles. And I think it makes you think that that's how it always was. But if you ask any writer about that beautiful book that they just wrote, you know, what they didn't show you is all the sanding and buffing, the polishing, the cutting, the torture that went before it. When I was writing my book, about 3/4 in, I started reading, when I went to bed, Mindy Kaling's book, you know, Why Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me, or something like that. And you're reading it and it's just like butter. You're like, oh my gosh, why can't I write like this? It's, you know, she must have sat down at a table with a pen and a piece of paper and it just came out. So then I get towards the end of her book and she talks about the harrowing, you know, torturous process that it was for her to, you know, eke out this book, to, like, you know, to bludgeon it into shape. And I thought, oh, her writing is fluent at the end, but just like me, a fellow writer, it's so hard to get there. So I think the kind of mythology of success is that, you know, when you see excellence and it's so fluent and so beautiful, as Martha Graham, the dancer, would say, it's glamorous. What's hidden are all those hours and days and nights and weeks and years of practice, of stumbling, of imperfection. And if we, you know, want to believe that occasionally, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's kind of fun. But what I worry about is that young people might get the wrong idea about their own stumbling and their own failing and say, well, I'll never be great. I'm a natural because it's hard for me. When in fact, it's hard for everyone.
And you have a couple of equations in the book which sort of go to that. And it also gets into this idea that, you know, 5,000 hours, you have to put 5,000 hours into something. But your equations say, well, you have to have some talent times effort equals skill. But more importantly, skill times effort, continued effort, that's what equals achievement.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in a sense that, you know, I'm using these in the kind of way metaphorically almost, right? I mean, look, if you have aptitude for something, if you have talent for something and you never try, then you'll never develop skill. What if you were talented at music but never took a music lesson, never picked up an instrument? Sure, you're talented at music, but you're not skilled in music. Okay, once you acquire skill, you've been engaged, you had some lessons, you practiced. Okay, now you can play. Well, what if you stop playing? Well, now you're not producing any achievements either, because even though you could play, but you stop playing, you know, there are no accomplishments that you can point to, like this recital, you know, that recording. So I think in that sense, you can argue that talent does count, of course, but in the sense that effort counts both for skill development and then also for using that skill to create achievements, you can argue that effort counts twice.
Well, one of the first stories you relate in the book is your experience in how to apply this sort of understanding of grit, or getting to know what grit is in real life situations. And of course, you've consulted for, you know, governments, for big, huge Fortune 500 companies and sports teams. But one of the most interesting experiences you write about is working with the U.S. Military Academy. Now, the Military Academy, to get an appointment is you have to have it from a congressman or a senator. It takes a great deal of effort. You have to have great grades. And yet you have all this work to be getting an appointment to this Military Academy, yet 20% won't graduate from the Military Academy of the people who get appointments. And big majority of those 20% never make it to the first day of class their freshman year. They drop out during Beast Barracks, the summer before they begin their schooling. What did you find out from looking at how the military academy selects their people? How have you helped them change the sort of people they're looking for?
Well, I have been working closely with West Point for now over a decade, and I have a couple things to say about West Point. You know, one is that you're absolutely right that in the course of your training, there are many times that you can drop out. But for me as a psychologist, the most interesting time of dropout was that very first summer. I mean, in a sense, your military training hadn't really even had a chance to begin. And after spending so much time and so much effort getting into the place, to drop out in the first few weeks is, I think, to me, interesting. That's where we found grit to be the most predictive of dropout. The young men and women who, despite being top of their class with great SAT scores and varsity athletic records, sometimes being captain, you know, that these young men and women still in some ways were finding it incredibly hard to be not at the top, you know, not to be doing things easily. That I think is really interesting, because there are so many other circumstances in life where, you know, that first time that you're not at the top and things aren't easy, you know, when do you stay in and when do you drop out? We found grit to be very predictive there. The second thing I'll say about West Point, which is fascinating to me, is that over those years that I have been studying West Point, things have changed. And in fact, the culture has changed in very intentional ways. And whereas when I started studying at West Point, 6 or 7% of the class would drop out in that first summer training. Now the numbers are, you know, 1% dropping out. So it's plummeted, right? Men and women are now staying through that summer training, whereas they didn't in such large numbers before. Well, what's going on? If you ask General Robert Caslin, who is the superintendent of West Point, what's going on, he would say it's an intentional cultural shift. West Point has always been challenging and always will be challenging. They consider themselves the cradle for military leaders, the elite of the elite for the U.S. Army. So they're not lowering their standards. But the thing that is changing is the culture of support. It used to be, when he was a young man, that at West Point, when you weren't cutting it, people just yelled at you and told you you were awful, and, you know, they used other words than awful. Now, when you're higher ups see that you're not running fast enough, or you can't do enough sit-ups, or, you know, you're not holding the weapon correctly, they go in there and they make a plan with you, and they try to support you. So they're not lowering their standards, but they are trying to be, I think, a more supportive, respectful culture. And I think that for me, as much as anything else, that fascinates me, that an organization, that a culture like West Point continues to evolve. And in this case, I think in very positive ways.
You actually wrote this. I think the general was talking about how they changed the view of how, you know, respect is very much a big part of it, because your upperclassmen are sort of your officers in a way. And before, where that respect was drilled into them through, you know, sort of this challenging sort of personal approach, now it's the leaders demonstrate respect to their subordinates to gain respect from their subordinates.
Yeah, and the idea of that actually goes back very, very far in West Point's history, because one of its first superintendents, Schofield, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, I'm sure a real West Pointer would be able to correct me, actually had this code of discipline where he said, a true leader does not rule by force, you know, by fist. A true leader, you know, is a model of respect and humility, and that is how you command the people below you. And so I think the idea is that we're, in a way, remembering some very old lessons about how to bring out the best in people. It's not always been, I think, part of the real culture, but in fact, every West Point cadet for years has had to memorize those words. And so now I think they're just trying to put them into the actual practice in a way that's much more meaningful.
Now, have they started picking cadets sort of based on your grit scale? You have a grit scale that you reproduce in the book, which I imagine it's a little simplified, but it's basically questions that sort of look at your ability to stick to a task, to be single-minded in that task in many ways, and to be passionate about that task and not be distracted by other, perhaps, rewards or interest. Are they using that at all?
Well, they're not, because I'm telling them not to use the scale. Neither am I telling any CEO, and here's why. You know, do I think that the grit scale gives you a signal of how gritty you are? Absolutely, I do. That's why I'm able to do research studies with it. But importantly, you know, there's a lot of noise, too. Like, for example, if you think about what it means to be a hard worker to you, and then you rate yourself on that question, or I finish whatever I begin, or, you know, how consistent are my interests from year to year? You know, how consistent are my goals, my passions? You know, for all of us, when we answer a scale like that, well, first of all, if we wanted to, we could fake it.
Sure.
And so you don't want to add stakes, I think, to these kind of tests, because then you will, you know, pervert the scale. Second thing is, you know, it's interesting. I gave this scale out to a bunch of varsity athletes at University of North Carolina recently. I was just giving a talk, and I was using the scale more to illustrate my point. Afterwards, a very competitive diver in his senior year came up to me, and he said, look, I could see the diver next to me, and I saw their score. And let me tell you, that is no 4.2. I've been competing with this person for 4 years. And I rated myself lower, but I know that I am grittier. And I think that's partly because when you read a line like, I am a hard worker, you will bring to it your own frame of reference, your own standards. And one of the things that produces imperfect scores, right? I mean, I'm saying that the scale is good, but it's not perfect, is because we do bring those different standards. And so that will also influence. So for those reasons, among others, I don't think that places like West Point should use a questionnaire that was designed for research for admission. I do think the most important lesson that perhaps the generals are learning from the research that we've done is that these aspects of character like grit are very important. And maybe more than selecting for them, maybe the question is, you know, how do we intentionally cultivate them? You know, these men and women who come to West Point are, each and every one of them, marvelous specimens of our, you know, country. I mean, they are so wonderful. They have so much to give. And the question is, you know, how do we create a culture that will bring out the best in them? I think West Point's already doing a pretty good job of selection. I guess they're always interested in becoming better and better as a culture that then, you know, continues to grow these young people.
Yeah. Now, another relationship you have might surprise people. You have a sort of a buddy-buddy relationship with Pete Carroll, the coach of the Seattle Seahawks. Right when he saw your TED Talk, he started screaming at your image because he wanted the next part of the equation. He wanted the next part of the equation. And he says this is exactly what he's doing with the Seahawks, is trying to instill grit in all of his players.
Well, you know, Pete does have a habit of jumping up and down when he's enthusiastic about something. And so, you know, it's true. When he was watching my TED Talk, he tells me that, you know, he was all along with the ride. And he's like, that's the word, grit. That's exactly what we do here. And then when I got to the part where I said, and this is now 3 years ago, well, we don't really know how to teach it, but that's what I'm working on, and that's what we should be working on. He wanted to jump through the screen and tell me that he knew how to teach it, and that's what they're doing as a team, you know, very deliberately trying to get his players and his staff to find their passion, to develop their passion, to be a little harder working, to, you know, work to get a little better than they were yesterday, to be resilient when, you know, they have a bad game or a bad quarter. And I have been in touch with Pete. I've been in communication. I saw him in Seattle just last month, and I, you know, we exchange ideas about, you know, how you would do this. I would say this about athletic coaches, because he's not the only one that I talk to. You know, there are no great coaches who are not world-class psychologists, and Pete Carroll's no exception. And even more than being a great psychologist, a world-class psychologist, you know, they've got to put this stuff into practice, right? I mean, they actually have to do something, not just write papers. So I feel like if there's anybody who's learning more in this partnership, it's me.
Yeah. You talked earlier about a colleague that said, you know, really how to get that high level achievement. It's breaking that hard or incredibly difficult outcome down into a series of doable tasks. And it sounds like you're right that Pete does that, where it's, you know, you have this very high lofty goal, and it's a matter of bubbles beneath that goal, another set of goals beneath those goals. And it's just systematically working on it and working hard towards mastery of more of those little small goals to get to a larger goal.
One of the people I talked to about this most recently, and it was just yesterday actually, was Kerry Close. She's the speller. I talk about her in the book. Yeah. I studied her when she was a little girl, and she won the National Spelling Bee. And she and I were talking about what she learned in 5 years of preparing for National Spelling Bee competition, because she only won in her fifth year of competition in five consecutive years. So she has spent thousands of hours, you know, memorizing the dictionary, looking up word origins and definitions. And I said, you know, what did you learn from that, Kerry? And she said, you know, I learned something that was very important for the rest of my life, which is if you take a very big thing, like trying to win the National Spelling Bee, And you really break it down part by part. Okay, there are the Latin words, and there are French words, and there are, like, you know, the words that are from Old English. Okay, now let's break that down. Okay, what about, you know, there's this page and there's that page. You break down a very big thing into tiny little things, and you try to accomplish them one by one by one. You know, I really think that is the path to excellence. It really resonates with me in terms of my own work. You know, you just take a very big thing and you start to break it down. And the very big thing, you think, oh, I'll never be able to do that. But the little things, you know, the littler the better. And I think that's what coaches do in practice. You know, they really help their players work on one specific thing at a time. They give them feedback. You don't go out on the field and say, like, be a better football player. You know, be a better wide receiver. You know, that's not helpful. And I think all great teachers try to do that with their students, but it's a really wonderful lesson for us. It makes excellence much more accessible than it seems when you just look at something in its entirety.
Now, one other question you've been asking and are probably still asking in your research is how's the best way to instill grit in the people you care for, your children or people you care for? And you outlined two approaches. One is this sort of system of unrelenting high standards, sort of a moralistic, in many ways, sort of look. And then the other is a sort of a nurturing, loving support work, like you're talking about at the military academy, where it's sort of, you know, how can we help you achieve this? How can we get you up to this level? And I assume there are success cases in both and probably failures in both approaches.
You know, they're always, you know, exactly as you say, you know, you can think of a story like, well, what about my next door neighbor's kid? You know, his parents did this. But what a psychologist always looks for is the pattern, right? Because we always want to give advice based on, okay, sure, there can be exceptions, but is there a rule? You know, is there a general trend here? And the trend that we find as psychologists, when you look at parenting and leadership as being really the best, most reliable way to cultivate qualities like grit, it is to be both challenging and supportive. It's tough love. You know, I mean, if you're just tough, you know, there will certainly be a few very, you know, rare exceptions who get through your toughness and end up being awesome anyway. And if you're just loving, there'll be people who bring themselves to those high standards on their own. But really, the most reliable recipe for parenting and leadership is to be both. You know, to be that teacher or that boss who says, you know, this isn't good enough. Here are my 17 suggestions about how you make this better. But because I'm supportive, I'm going to tell you I know you can do it. I'm here to help you if you need me to. And there's no sense of insecurity, I think, when you have a leader like this. You kind of know they always have your back. You kind of know that at some level, their respect for you and their support is unconditional. And I think really that's where you want to be. And that's what Steve Young describes his parents being when, you know, this is the NFL quarterback Hall of Famer. That is how, you know, so many of the paragons of grit that I've studied will describe, you know, their best coaches, their best teachers. Sometimes they'll tell me that one parent was challenging and the other was supportive, but almost always they can kind of point to these two sources of influence. But I don't think any kid, no matter who they are, they all thrive when they're given things that they can't yet do, that are just beyond what they can do, and when they know that they're respected and that they're loved. And I think that's really kind of the big trend, the big rule. And when there are exceptions, you know, again, you can say, yes, they exist, but they are exceptions. You know, there are more kids who thrive with, you know, both the support and the challenge.
All right. The name of the book is Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. Angela Duckworth, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. I so enjoyed it.
Angela Duckworth is a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.